biased coins are flipped in repeated trials, the result will almost always be very close to half heads, half tails. Whereas if only 10 coins are flipped at a time, an exact split will be obtained only occasionally, and in one in an average 512 trials, all the coins will be either all heads or all tails. Now think of sexual reproduction as the equivalent of coin flipping, and each generation as a new coin flipping trial. The change in gene frequency from one generation to the next by chance is evolution by genetic drift. In populations with 100 individuals or fewer, genetic drift can be a potent force. Its rate can be precisely described by statistical measures that tell us about the fate of large samples of populations of the same size. These measures reveal that the main effect of genetic drift is to reduce variation by eliminating some of the gene forms. That, combined with the randomness of the change, means that genetic drift is a far less creative process than natural selection. As natural selection is added to the models, it reduces the impact of genetic drift while driving the gene frequencies in one direction or another at predictable velocities. Population geneticists make their models still more complex and presumably closer to nature in various ways. For example, they decree mating to be non-random, or break populations into fragments that continue to exchange migrants, or arrange for constellations of genes rather than single genes to prescribe the character traits. The models of population geneticists yield exact predictions in the virtual worlds bounded by the assumptions selected for evaluation. They can often be matched by carefully managed populations of animals and plants in the laboratory. They are notoriously poor, however, at predicting evolution in nature. The flaw is not in the internal logic of the theory, but in the unpredictability of nature itself. The environment constantly shifts, altering the values of the parameters that geneticists put into their models. Climatic change and weather catastrophes break up some populations while freeing others to expand and coalesce. New predators and competitors invade as old ones retreat. Disease sweeps the habitats. Traditional food sources vanish, and new ones appear. Evolutionary biologists, like weather forecasters, are confounded by the turbulence of the real world. They have had some success in predicting changes in small ensembles of genes and traits over a few generations. They can explain retrospectively many of the major twists and turns of long-term evolution from the fossil record and from the logical reconstruction of family trees of living species, but rarely have they been able to predict future events with any degree of accuracy. They have equal difficulty retrodicting past events, that is, predicting the occurrence of such past events before a search is made for traces of the events and reconstructions are performed. They are unlikely to do so until ecology and the other environmental sciences have sufficiently matured to become predictive themselves and thus provide the full and exact context in which evolution occurs. Economics, at the cutting edge of the social sciences, shares the same difficulties as population genetics and the environmental sciences. It is battered by exogenous shocks. All the unaccountable events of history and environmental change that push the parameter values up and down. That alone limits the accuracy of economic predictions. Except in the most general and statistical terms, economic models cannot forecast the onset of bull and bear markets or the decades-long cycles triggered by war and technological innovation. They cannot tell us whether tax cuts or national deficit reduction is the more effective in raising per capita income, or how economic growth will affect income distribution. Economic theory is impeded by a second, equally fundamental difficulty. Unlike population genetics and the environmental sciences, it lacks a solid foundation of units and processes. It has not acquired or even attempted serious consilience with the natural sciences. All analysts understand that the broad patterns of economic process originate in some fashion or other from vast numbers of decisions made by human beings, whether as individuals or as members of firms and governmental agencies. The most sophisticated models of economic theory attempt to translate such microeconomic behavior into the larger aggregate measures and patterns broadly defined as the economy. In economics, and in the remainder of the social sciences as well, the translation from individual to aggregate behavior is the key analytic problem. Yet in these disciplines, the exact nature and sources of individual behavior are rarely considered. Instead, the knowledge used by the modelers is that of folk psychology, based mostly on common perception and unaided intuition, and folk psychology has already been pushed way past its limit. The flaw is not fatal. Economic theory is not Ptolemaic, not so structurally defective that a revolution in conception is needed. The most advanced of the micro to macro models are on the right track. But the theorists have unnecessarily handicapped themselves by closing off their theory from serious biology and psychology, comprising principles drawn from close description, experiments, and statistical analysis. They have done so, I believe, in order to avoid entanglement in the formidable complexities of these foundation sciences. Their strategy has been to solve the micro to macro problem with the fewest possible assumptions at the micro level. In other words, they have carried parsimony too far. Economic theories also aim to create models of the widest possible application, often crafting abstractions so extreme as to represent little more than exercises in applied mathematics. That is generality carried too far. The result of such stringency is a body of theory that is internally consistent, but little else. Although economics, in my opinion, is headed in the right direction and provides the wedge behind which social theory will wisely follow, it is still mostly irrelevant. The strengths and weaknesses of economic theory are illustrated in the work of Gary S. Becker of the University of Chicago, awarded the 1992 Nobel Prize in Economic Science for having extended the domain of economic theory to aspects of human behavior which had previously been dealt with, if at all, by other social science disciplines, such as sociology, demography, and criminology. What Becker accomplished was to cut more deeply than previous economists into the sources of human preferences. He recognized that most of economic reasoning is based on the implicit assumption that people are driven by basic biological needs for food, shelter, and recreation. But there are other incentives, he said, such as the type of housing and furniture, the restaurants, and forms of leisure they prefer that lie outside the elemental imperatives. All these choices and more depend on variations in personal experience and social forces beyond individual control. If human behavior is to be explained fully, the utility of the choices, that is, their value perceived by the consumer, must be entered into economics models. The inviolable assumption of Becker's thinking is the principle of rational choice. Introduced by earlier economists as the keystone of quantitative modeling, It says simply that people maximize their satisfaction by acts based on calculation. Economic models using this conception had been largely limited to utility based on narrow self-interest. Becker urged his fellow economists to broaden their vista to include the subject matter of the other social sciences. They should consider desires that are variously altruistic, loyal, spiteful, and masochistic. These, too, he argued, are forces that govern rational choice. Extending the reach of formal models, Becker and other economists of like mind have addressed with greater confidence some of industrial society's most vexing problems. Turning to criminology, they have recommended methods of optimal deterrence, economic, of course, for different classes of offense, from capital crimes and armed robbery to embezzlement, tax evasion, and the breaking of laws that regulate business and environmental protection. Venturing into sociology, they have assessed the impact of racial discrimination on production and unemployment and of economic class on marital choice. In public health, they have analyzed the effects of legalization and tax loads on the use of cigarettes and controlled substances. Their models contain elegant graphical representations and analytic solutions to theoretical problems of equilibria. Yet, seen through the established principles of the behavioral sciences, they are simplistic and often misleading. The choices in personal behavior reduce to a small number of options, such as whether to smoke or not, to marry within the same socioeconomic class or not, to risk committing a crime, or to move to a same-race neighborhood. The predictions consist of more of this, less of that, and they approximate thresholds at which trends will commence, taper off, or reverse direction. Typically, the predictions arise from the common-sense intuitions of the modeler, that is, from folk psychology, and, following a series of formal analytical steps, confirm common-sense beliefs. We are told in crisp technical language that a permanent increase in the price of cigarettes reduces consumption from the outset more than a temporary increase. That in order to preserve their wealth, the rich take measures to avoid meeting and falling in love with the poor. That people gain satisfaction from going to already popular restaurants, even if competitors are as good in price and cuisine and so forth. Seldom are the premises of such models examined closely. Seldom are their conclusions tested to any depth with quantitative field data. Their appeal is in the chrome and roar of the engine, not the velocity or destination. The goal of psychologically oriented analysts such as Becker, as well as Jack Hirschleifer, Thomas Schelling, Amartya Sen, George Stigler, and others of similar interests, is to strengthen microeconomics and draw from it more accurate predictions of macroeconomic behavior. That, of course, is admirable. To advance much further, however, they and other social scientists will have to cross the boundary between the social and natural sciences and trade with the biologists and psychologists they find on the other side. Just as in his Nobel lecture, Becker stated that his contribution was to pry economists away from narrow assumptions about self-interest. The next step is for economists to free themselves completely, at long last, from the standard social science model of behavior and take seriously the biological and psychological foundations of human nature. Amazingly, despite overwhelming evidence against it, the great majority still cling to the view that aside from meeting basic biological needs, people in modern societies make choices, in Becker's words, that depend on childhood, social interactions, and cultural influences. not, apparently, the hereditary epigenetic rules of human nature. The impoverishing consequence of this view has been the acceptance of folk psychology in even the most ingenious models. To infuse psychology and biology into economic and other social theory, which can only be to its advantage, means teasing out and examining microscopically the delicate concepts of utility by asking why people ultimately lean towards certain choices, and being so predisposed, why and under what circumstances they act upon them. Beyond this task lies the micro to macro problem, the ensemble of processes by which the mass of individual decisions are translated into social patterns, and beyond that, framed by a still wider scale of space and time, is the co-evolution problem, the means by which biological evolution influences culture, and the reverse. Together, these domains, human nature, micro to macro transition, and the co-evolution of genes and culture, require the full traverse from the social sciences to psychology, and thence to the brain sciences and genetics. The evidence from scattered studies in psychology and biology already suggests certain generalizations about utility. The categories of choice, the major activities in moment-by-moment thought and behavior, are epistatic. Needs and opportunities in one category alter the strength of others. The rank order in dominance among categories such as sex, status protection, and play appears to be genetically programmed. Some needs and opportunities are not just epistatic, but preemptive. Conditions such as drug addiction and sexual possessiveness can hijack emotions to focus on unitary goals so powerful as to virtually delete activities in many other categories. Rational calculation is based on surges of competing emotions whose interplay is resolved by an interaction of hereditary and environmental factors. Incest avoidance, for example, is underlaid by a strong hereditary epigenetic rule. It can be reinforced by cultural taboos or overcome by special, increasingly well-understood personal experiences. Rational calculation is often unselfish. For complex, still poorly understood reasons, some of the most powerful emotions are patriotism and altruism. It remains a surprising fact that a substantial percentage of people are willing, at a moment's notice, to risk their lives to save those of strangers. Choices are group-dependent. That much is obvious. But what is less well-known is that the power of peer influence varies strikingly from category to category of behavior. Clothing style, for example, is almost wholly dependent on peer influences, while incest avoidance is largely independent. Do these differences have a genetic basis and thus an evolutionary history? Probably they do. And it is time to start examining them for this possibility more carefully. Decision-making is shaped category by epigenetic rules, which are the innate propensities to learn certain options in the first place and then to select particular ones among them. On average, many of the propensities differ according to age and gender. The psychobiological subtlety of decision-making is nicely illustrated by the little r to big K continuum of reproductive strategies. When resources are few and unstable, people tend to adopt a little r strategy, preferring many children to ensure that at least a few will survive. When resources are abundant and stable, they lean toward a big K strategy, in which fewer high-quality offspring are carefully protected and educated for entry at an upper socioeconomic level. The symbol little r refers in demography to the rate of population growth, which rises with the little r strategy, and the symbol big K to the carrying capacity of the environment, the size at which population growth ceases. Overlying the little r big K continuum is the general tendency of socially powerful males to acquire multiple women of reproductive age, thereby boosting their Darwinian edge. The full understanding of utility will come from biology and psychology by reduction to the elements of human behavior followed by bottom-up synthesis, not from the social sciences by top-down inference and guesswork based on intuitive knowledge. It is in biology and psychology that economists and other social scientists will find the premises needed to fashion more predictive models, just as it was in physics and chemistry that researchers found premises that upgraded biology. The performance of future social theory also depends on a psychobiological understanding of the process of reason itself. At present, the dominant mode of explanation is the aforementioned rational choice theory. First conceived in economics, then spread to political science and other disciplines, its central conception is that above all else, human beings are rational in their actions. They examine as best they can all the pertinent factors and weigh the likely outcome of following each potential choice in turn. They add in cost and benefit, investment, risk, and emotional and material return before deciding. The preferred option is that which maximizes utility. This is not an adequate picture of how people think. The human brain is not a very swift calculator, and most decisions have to be made rather quickly, in complex settings, and with incomplete information. So the question of importance in rational choice theory is, how much information is enough? In other words, at what point do people stop reflecting and make up their minds? One simple strategy that provides a cutoff point is satisficing, a Scottish term that combines satisfying and sufficing. Introduced to psychology in 1957 by Herbert Simon, an economist at Carnegie Mellon University, satisficing means taking the first satisfactory choice encountered out of those perceived and reasonably available in the short term, as opposed to visualizing the optimum choice in advance and searching until it is found. A young man, ready for marriage, is more likely, by satisficing, to propose to the most attractive prospect among the available women of his acquaintance than to search at length for a preconceived ideal mate. An alternative to this, and other conceptions of traditional rational choice, is that people follow rules of thumb, known more technically as heuristics. The idea was first advanced by the American psychologists Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky in 1974. Rather than calculate costs and benefits, people act upon simple cues and heuristics that work most of the time. By this means, the complex tasks of assessing probabilities and predicting outcomes are reduced to a few judgmental operations. Usually, heuristics work and save a great deal of time and energy, but in many situations they lead to large systematic error. An example is the heuristic used in rapid arithmetical calculation and known as anchoring. You can see how it works by comparing the following two sets of multiplied numbers for 5 seconds and guessing the products. 8 times 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5 times 6 times 7 times 8. Most people give the first set the higher value, even though the two sets of numbers are identical. They anchor their guess on the first numbers encountered. They also underestimate both. High school students tested by Kahneman and Tversky averaged 2,250 for the set that went from 8 to 1, and 512 for the set that went from 1 to 8, whereas the correct answer for both is 40,320. Here is an example of a systematically inaccurate heuristic in the realm of probability. A majority of people, watching a coin being tossed, believe that the following sequence of 6 alternating heads and tails. Heads, tails, heads, tails, tails, heads is more likely to occur than one with the same elements repeated in groups, such as heads, 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 tails, tails, tails. In fact, both are equally probable. Why are such consistent errors made by minds that can be trained to grasp calculus and statistics? The correct answer may lie in genetic evolution. Over thousands of generations, the brain evolved to handle simple numbers and proportions, but not complex problems requiring abstract quantitative reasoning. The heuristics illustrated by the two examples just described are therefore folk mathematics, although their solutions are skewed in attempts at complex formal calculation, they may work very well in real life, where most first impressions accurately prefigure events to follow. The same explanation fits other odd mistakes made by heuristics. For example, a familiar dish with a different taste is likely to be passed over, even though the ingredients are demonstrably fresh and wholesome. Following a plane crash, many intercity travelers switch to automobiles, even though they know the fatality rate per passenger mile is much higher on the road. Irrational choices, yes, but perhaps obedient to the superordinate heuristic of risk aversion, which can be translated in these two examples as follows. Take no chances whatsoever with food poisoning and stay away from places where others have been recently killed, regardless of what the mathematical laws of probability tell you. Further research may reveal that the brain sometimes operates as a computer-like optimizer and sometimes as a quick decision-maker ruled by powerful and inborn heuristics. Whatever the mix, rational choice theory, though still the light and the way to many social theorists, is a subject of controversy within psychology. It is too dependent, critics say, on analogies with computer algorithms and abstract optimality solutions. It pays too little attention to the properties of the real brain, which is a Stone Age organ evolved over hundreds of millennia and only recently thrust into the alien environment of industrialized society. It is thus inconsistent with the evidence of how people in pre-literate cultures reason, and have likely reasoned, throughout evolutionary time. These qualities have been summarized by C.R. Hallpike in The Foundations of Primitive Thought as follows. Intuitive and dogmatic, bound up with specific emotional relationships rather than physical causality, preoccupied with essences and metamorphosis, opaque to logical abstraction or arrays of the hypothetically possible, prone to use language for social interaction rather than as a conceptual tool, limited in quantification mostly to rough images of frequency and rarity, and inclined to view mind as stemming partly from the environment and able to project back out into it so that words become entities with power unto themselves. It will be at once apparent, and should be a working premise of economists and other social scientists, that the same pre-literate traits are commonplace in citizens of modern industrial societies. They are intensified among cult members, the deeply religious, and the less educated. They permeate and enrich the metaphors of art. They are, like it or not, part of modern civilization. Systematic, logico-deductive thought, which is very much a specialized product of Western culture, comes hard, on the other hand, and is still rare. While perfecting it, we will be wise, I think, to discipline the old ways of thought, but never to abandon them, never to forget that as part of adaptive human nature, they conducted us, alive and fecund, all the way to the present age. The magnitude of the technical problems facing the social theorists in particular is, I readily concede, extremely daunting. Some philosophers of science have thrown up their hands, declaring that the borderlands between the natural and social sciences are too complex to be mastered by contemporary imagination and may lie forever beyond reach. Questioning the very idea of consilience from biology to culture, they point to the non-linearity of the viable equations, to second and third order interactions of factors, to stochasticity, and to all the other monsters that dwelleth in the great maelstrom sea, and they sigh, no hope, no hope. But that is what philosophers are supposed to do. Their task is to define and explain the limits of science in the larger scheme of things, where the full dimensions of rational process are better left to, well, philosophers. For them to concede that science has no intellectual limits would be unseemly. It would be unprofessional. Their misgivings lend strength to that dwindling number of social theorists who wish to keep the borders of their dominions sealed and the study of culture unroiled by the dreams of biology. Scientists themselves are fortunately not so bound. If past generations had been so deeply reflective and humble before the unknown, our comprehension of the universe would have stopped growing in the 16th century. The chastening sting of the philosopher's tongue is needed, but should be taken with the antidote of self-assurance and never allowed to be fatal. It is the opposite conviction, blind faith, if you prefer, that has propelled science and technology into the modern age. Bear in mind that the original Enlightenment died within philosophy, but not within science. The more pessimistic philosophers may be right about the social sciences, of course, but it is better to press on as if they were wrong. There is only one way to find out. The more forbidding the task, the greater the prize for those who dare to undertake it. Chapter 10. The Arts and Their Interpretation. In many respects, the most interesting challenge to consilient explanation is the transit from science to the arts. By the latter, I mean the creative arts, the personal productions of literature, visual arts, drama, music, and dance, marked by those qualities which, for lack of better words, and better words may never be coined, we call the true and beautiful. The arts are sometimes taken to mean all the humanities, which include not only the creative arts, but also, following the recommendations of the 1979 to 1980 Commission on the Humanities, the core subjects of history, philosophy, languages, and comparative literature, plus jurisprudence, the comparative study of religions, and those aspects of the social sciences which have humanistic content and employ humanistic methods. Nevertheless, the arts in the primary and intuitively creative sense, ars gratia artis, remain the definition most widely and usefully employed. Reflection leads us to two questions about the arts: where they come from, in both history and personal experience, and how their essential qualities of truth and beauty are to be described through ordinary language. These matters are the central concern of interpretation, the scholarly analysis, and criticism of the arts. Interpretation is itself partly an art, since it expresses not just the factual expertise of the critic, but also his character and aesthetic judgment. When of high quality, criticism can be as inspired and idiosyncratic as the work it addresses. Further, as I now hope to show, it can also be part of science, and science part of it. Interpretation will be the more powerful when braided together from history, biography, personal confession, and science. The profane word now having been spoken on hallowed ground, a quick disclaimer is in order. While it is true that science advances by reducing phenomena to their working elements, by dissecting brains into neurons, for example, and neurons into molecules, it does not aim to diminish the integrity of the whole. On the contrary, synthesis of the elements to recreate their original assembly is the other half of scientific procedure. In fact, it is the ultimate goal of science. Nor is there any reason to suppose that the arts will decline as science flourishes. They are not, as suggested recently by the distinguished literary critic George Steiner, in a twilight, past high noon in Western civilization, thus unlikely to witness the reappearance of a Dante, a Michelangelo, or a Mozart. I can conceive of no intrinsic limit to future originality and brilliance in the arts as the consequence of the reductionist understanding of the creative process in the arts and science. On the contrary, an alliance is overdue and can be achieved through the medium of interpretation. Neither science nor the arts can be complete without combining their separate strengths. Science needs the intuition and metaphorical power of the arts, and the arts need the fresh blood of science. Scholars in the humanities should lift the anathema placed on reductionism. Scientists are not conquistadors out to melt the Inca gold. Science is free, and the arts are free, and as I argued in the earlier account of mind, the two domains, despite the similarities in their creative spirit, have radically different goals and methods. The key to the exchange between them is not hybridization, not some unpleasantly self-conscious form of scientific art or artistic science, but reinvigoration of interpretation with the knowledge of science and its proprietary sense of the future. Interpretation is the logical channel of consilient explanation between science and the arts. For a promising example, out of many that might be chosen, consider the episode in Paradise Lost, Book 4, when in a riveting narrative, Milton sends Satan to Eden. Upon arrival, the arch felon and grand thief leaps a barrier of impenetrable bramble and a high wall, and settles like a cormorant in the branches of the Tree of Life. He waits for the fall of night, when he can enter the dreams of innocent Eve. Milton now unleashes his imaginative powers to tell us what humanity is about to lose. All around the roosting schemer is the environment designed by God to aesthetic perfection. Crisped brooks, rolling on orient pearl and sands of gold, descend to a lake that to the fringed bank with myrtle crowned her crystal mirror holds. All through the blessed oasis grow flowers of all hue, and without thorn the rose. Milton, though now blind, has retained a fine sense of biophilia, the innate pleasure from living abundance and diversity, particularly as manifested by the human impulse to imitate nature with gardens. But he is far from satisfied with the mere dream of natural harmony. In 8 lines of astonishing symphonic power, he tries to capture the mythic core of paradise. Not that fair field of Enna, where Proserpine, gathering flowers, herself a fairer flower, by gloomy Dis was gathered, which cost Ceres all that pain to seek her through the world, nor that sweet grove of Daphne by Orontes, and the inspired Castalian spring might with this paradise of Eden strive. How can anyone hope to express creation's heart at the dawn of time? Milton tries. He summons archetypes that have descended undiminished from ancient Greece and Rome to his own time, and thereafter to ours. They are of a kind, as I will suggest later, that are also innate to the human mental process. He shadows beauty with a hint of tragedy, giving us the untrammeled and fertile world awaiting corruption. He transforms the beauty of the garden into that of a young woman, Proserpine, about to be seized and taken away to the underworld by the god Dis. She, as nature's beauty, will be concealed in darkness because of conflict between gods. Ceres, Proserpine's mother and goddess of agriculture, turns in grief from her duties, and the world plunges into famine. The passion of Apollo for beautiful Daphne is unrequited. In order to escape, she turns into a tree, a laurel, in a garden of her own. Milton means to play on the emotions of readers of his own time, the 17th century, when Hellenic mythology was second nature to the educated mind. He counterposes emotions to magnify their force. Beauty clashes with darkness, freedom with fate, passion with denial. Building tension, he leads us through lesser paradises to arrive suddenly at the mystical prototype of Eden. In yet another well-grounded artifice, reliance on authority, Milton chooses allusions not to his own time, not, for example, to Cromwell and Charles II and the Restoration, from which he himself has narrowly escaped death, he had championed revolution and the Commonwealth, but to ancient texts of another civilization, ancient Greece and Rome, robust enough to have survived in remembrance across centuries. He conveys by their use that what we are not told, we must know nevertheless to be true. The defining quality of the arts is the expression of the human condition by mood and feeling, calling into play all the senses, evoking both order and disorder. From where, then, does the ability to create art arise? Not cold logic based on fact, not God's guidance of Milton's thoughts, as the poet himself believed. Nor is there any evidence of a unique spark that ignites such genius as is evident in Paradise Lost. Experiments using brain imaging, for example, have failed to disclose singular neurobiological traits in musically gifted people. Instead, they show engagement of a broader area of the same parts of the brain used by those less able. History supports this incremental hypothesis. Behind Shakespeare, Leonardo, Mozart, and others in the foremost rank are a vast legion whose realized powers form a descending continuum to those who are merely competent. What the masters of the Western canon and those of other high cultures possessed in common was a combination of exceptional knowledge, technical skill, originality, sensitivity to detail, ambition, boldness, and drive. They were obsessed. They burned within. But they also had an intuitive grasp of inborn human nature accurate enough to select commanding images from the mostly inferior thoughts that stream through the minds of all of us. The talent they wielded may have been only incrementally greater, but their creations appeared to others to be qualitatively new. They acquired enough influence and longevity to translate into lasting fame. not by magic, not by divine benefaction, but by a quantitative edge in powers shared in smaller degree with those less gifted. They gathered enough lifting speed to soar above the rest. Artistic inspiration, common to everyone in varying degree, rises from the artesian wells of human nature. Its creations are meant to be delivered directly to the sensibilities of the beholder without analytic explanation. Creativity is therefore humanistic in the fullest sense. Works of enduring value are those truest to these origins. It follows that even the greatest works of art might be understood fundamentally with knowledge of the biologically evolved epigenetic rules that guided them. This is not the prevailing view of the arts. Academic theorists have paid little attention to biology. Consilience is not in their vocabulary. To varying degrees, they have been more influenced by postmodernism, the competing hypothesis that denies the existence of a universal human nature. Applied to literary criticism, the extreme manifestation of postmodernism is the deconstructive philosophy, formulated most provocatively by Jacques Derrida and Paul Demain. In this view, truth is relative and personal. Each person creates his own inner world by acceptance or rejection of endlessly shifting linguistic signs. There is no privileged point, no lodestar, to guide literary intelligence. And given that science is just another way of looking at the world, there is no scientifically constructible map of human nature from which the deep meaning of texts can be drawn. There is only unlimited opportunity for the reader to invent interpretations and commentaries out of the world he himself constructs. "The author is dead" is a favorite maxim of the deconstructionists. Deconstructionist scholars search instead for contradictions and ambiguities. They conceive and analyze what is left out by the author. The missing elements allow for personalized commentary in the postmodernist style. Postmodernists, who add political ideology to the mix, also regard the traditional literary canon as little more than a collection confirming the worldview of ruling groups, and in particular, that of Western white males. The postmodernist hypothesis does not conform well to the evidence. It is blissfully free of existing information on how the mind works. Yet there is surely some reason for the popularity of postmodernism other than a love of chaos. If the competing biological approach is correct, its widespread appeal must be rooted in human nature. Postmodernism in the arts is more than a school of resentment, Harold Bloom's indictment in the Western canon, and more than the eunuch's spite, to borrow a phrase from Alexander Pope, and it is sustained by more than the pathetic reverence commonly given Gallic obscurantism by American academics. There is also a surge of revolutionary spirit in postmodernism, generated by the real, not deconstructed, fact that large segments of the population, most notably women, have unique talents and emotional lives that have been relatively neglected for centuries and are only now beginning to find full expression within the mainstream culture. If we are to believe evidence from the biological and behavioral sciences gathered especially during the past quarter century, women differ genetically from men in ways other than reproductive anatomy. In aggregate, on average, with wide statistical overlap, and in many venues of social experience, they speak with a different voice. Today, it is being heard loud and clear. But I do not read the welcome triumph of feminism, social, economic, and creative, as a brief for postmodernism. The advance, while opening new avenues of expression and liberating deep pools of talent has not exploded human nature into little pieces. Instead, it has set the stage for a fuller exploration of the universal traits that unite humanity. Looked at with a different perspective, postmodernism can also be viewed as one extreme in an historical oscillation in literary worldview. The great American critic Edmund Wilson noted in 1926 that Western literature seems obliged to vibrate in emphasis between the two poles of neoclassicism and romanticism. Conceived very broadly, the cycle can first be picked up in the Enlightenment with Pope, Racine, and other poets who drew on the scientists' vision of an orderly world. They were replaced in public esteem by the rebellious romantic poets of the 19th century, who yielded in turn to Flaubert and others returning to rational order, who gave way to a flow in the opposite direction, as embodied in the modernist writings of the French symbolists, including Mallarmé and Valéry, and of their British peers Yeats, Joyce, and Eliot. Because each of the extremes proved ultimately unbearable as a reigning fashion, Wilson said, it guaranteed reversion toward the opposite pole. The same mood swing can be seen in recent post-Wilsonian literary criticism. Earlier in this century, scholars stressed the personal experiences of the authors and the history of their times. In the 1950s, the new critics insisted on drawing out the full meaning of the text, without much concern for the personal history of the author. They agreed with Joseph Conrad's famous dictum that a work of art should carry its justification in every line. In the 1980s, the new critics quite suddenly gave way to the postmodernists, who argued the opposite approach. Search, they said, for what the text does not control, and explain the entirety as a social construction on the part of the author. Their stance has been summarized in a pointed manner by the poet and critic Frederick Turner as follows. Artists and poets should dismiss the constraints of nature, even in a time of ecological crisis, ignore science, abandon the forms and disciplines of the arts, and hence their own culture's shamanic tradition, turn away from the idea of a universal human nature, and, having freed themselves from such stifling confinement, favor snideness and rage over hope and other uplifting emotions. According to Turner, a reversal in fashion is already beginning. The tradition of Homer, Dante, Leonardo, Shakespeare, Beethoven, and Goethe is not dead. It is growing up in the cracks of the postmodern concrete. Edmund Wilson hoped for a damping of this perpetual cycle in the arts, which he considered a peculiar affliction of the modern mind. Favoring synthesis in principle, he wrote of his admiration for Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead, the two great culture unifiers of the first half of the 20th century. We envy the classics, he said, for the equilibrium they appear to have achieved. Regularity and logic in Sophocles do not exclude either tenderness or violence, and in Virgil, the sort of thing that Flaubert can do, the exact objective reproduction of things, does not exclude the sort of thing that Wordsworth and Shelley can do, the mysterious, the fluid, the pathetic, and the vague. I like to think that Edmund Wilson would have been favorable to the idea of consilience. Can the opposed Apollonian and Dionysian impulses, cool reason against passionate abandonment, which drive the mood swings of the arts and criticism, be reconciled? This is, I believe, an empirical question. Its answer depends on the existence or non-existence of an inborn human nature. The evidence accumulated to date leaves little room for doubt. Human nature exists, and it is both deep and highly structured. If that much is granted, the relation of science to interpretation of the arts can be made clearer as follows. Interpretation has multiple dimensions, namely history, biography, linguistics, and aesthetic judgment. At the foundation of them all lie the material processes of the human mind. Theoretically inclined critics of the past have tried many avenues into that subterranean realm, including, most prominently, psychoanalysis and postmodernist solipsism. These approaches, which are guided largely by unaided intuition about the way the brain works, have fared badly. In the absence of a compass based on sound material knowledge, they make too many wrong turns into blind ends. If the brain is ever to be charted, and an enduring theory of the arts created as part of the enterprise, it will be by stepwise and consilient contributions from the brain sciences, psychology, and evolutionary biology. And if, during this process, the creative mind is to be understood, it will need collaboration between scientists and humanities scholars. The collaboration, now in its early stages, is likely to conclude that innovation is a concrete biological process founded upon an intricacy of nerve circuitry and neurotransmitter release. It is not the outpouring of symbols by an all-purpose generator or any conjuration therein by ethereal agents. To fathom the origin of innovation in the arts will make a great deal of difference in the way we interpret its creations. The natural sciences have begun to form a picture of the mind, including some of the elements of the creative process itself. Although they are still considerably far from the ultimate goal, they cannot help in the end but strengthen interpretation of the arts. Charles Lumsden and I reached this conclusion in the early 1980s while developing the full theory of gene-culture coevolution described earlier. A similar position has been reached from different directions by a small but growing circle of artists and theorists of the arts, among whom the more prominent have been Joseph Carroll, Brett Cook, Ellen Desaniaki, Walter Koch, Robert Story, and Frederick Turner. Some of these scholars refer to their approach as biopoetics or bioaesthetics. The analyses have been independently bolstered by Irenaeus Eibel Eibesfeld, the German ethologist, in his Global Studies of Human Instinct, by the American anthropologists Robin Fox and Lionel Tiger in their accounts of ritual and folklore, and by numerous researchers in artificial intelligence, whose work on artistic innovation is summarized, to take one excellent exposition, by Margaret Bowden in The Creative Mind. The body of the research to date can be fitted together into the following narrative of coevolution of genes and culture. During human evolution, there was time enough for natural selection to shape the processes of innovation. For thousands of generations, sufficient for genetic changes in the brain and sensory and endocrine systems, variation among people in thought and behavior caused personal differences in survival and reproductive success. The variation was to some degree heritable. Individuals differed then, as they do today, not just in what they learned from their culture, but also in their hereditary propensity to learn certain things and to respond by statistical preponderance in particular ways. Genetic evolution inevitably ensued. Natural selection, favoring some of the gene ensembles over others, molded the epigenetic rules, which are the inherited regularities of mental development that compose human nature. Among the most ancient epigenetic rules I have described to this point are the Westermarck effect, which inhibits incest, and the natural aversion to snakes. Those of more recent origin, perhaps no more than 100,000 years ago, include the swift programmed steps by which children acquire language and, we may reasonably presume, some of the creative processes of the arts as well. Universals, or near-universals, emerged in the evolution of culture. Because of differences in strength among the underlying epigenetic rules, certain thoughts and behavior are more effective than others in the emotional responses they cause and the frequency with which they intrude on reverie and creative thought. They bias cultural evolution toward the invention of archetypes, the widely recurring abstractions and core narratives that are dominant themes in the arts. Examples of archetypes I have already mentioned are Oedipean tragedy, violating the Westermarck effect, and the serpent images of myth and religion. The arts are innately focused towards certain forms and themes, but are otherwise freely constructed. The archetypes spawn legions of metaphors that compose not only a large part of the arts, but also of ordinary communication. Metaphors, the consequence of spreading activation of the brain during learning, are the building blocks of creative thought. They connect and synergistically strengthen different spheres of memory. Gene culture coevolution is, I believe, the underlying process by which the brain evolved and the arts originated. It is the conceivable means most consistent with the joint findings of the brain sciences, psychology, and evolutionary biology. Still, direct evidence with reference to the arts is slender. It is possible that new discoveries concerning the brain and evolution will yet change the picture fundamentally. Such is the nature of science. The uncertainty makes the search for the alignment of science and the humanities all the more interesting a prospect. This much can be said with confidence, however. The growing evidence of an overall structured and powerful human nature, channeling development of the mind, favors a more traditionalist view of the arts. The arts are not solely shaped by errant genius out of historical circumstances and idiosyncratic personal experience. The roots of their inspiration date back in deep history to the genetic origins of the human brain and are permanent. While biology has an important part to play in scholarly interpretation, the creative arts themselves can never be locked in by this or any other discipline of science. The reason is that the exclusive role of the arts is the transmission of the intricate details of human experience by artifice to intensify aesthetic and emotional response. Works of art communicate feeling directly from mind to mind with no intent to explain why the impact occurs. In this defining quality, the arts are the antithesis of science. When addressing human behavior, science is coarse-grained and encompassing, as opposed to the arts, which are fine-grained and interstitial. That is, science aims to create principles and use them in human biology to define the diagnostic qualities of the species. The arts use fine details to flesh out and make strikingly clear, by implication, those same qualities. Works of art that prove enduring are intensely humanistic. Born in the imagination of individuals, they nevertheless touch upon what was universally endowed by human evolution. Even when, as part of fantasy, they imagine worlds that cannot possibly exist, they stay anchored to their human origins. As Kurt Vonnegut Jr., master fantasist, once pointed out, "The arts place humanity in the center of the universe, whether we belong there or not." Several special powers were granted the arts by the genetic evolution of the brain. First is the ability to generate metaphors with ease and move them fluidly from one context to another. Consider the technical language of the arts themselves. A plot first meant a physical site and building plan, then the stage director's plot or blocking plan, then the action or story blocked out. In the 16th century, a frontispiece was a decorated front of a building, then the title page of a book ornamented with a figure, usually the allegorical representation of a building, and finally, the illustrated page that precedes the title page. A stanza, which in Italian is a public room or resting place, has been appropriated in English to mean the room-like set of four or more lines separated typographically from other similar sets. In both the arts and sciences, the programmed brain seeks elegance, which is the parsimonious and evocative description of pattern to make sense out of a confusion of detail. Edward Rothstein, a critic trained in both mathematics and music, compares their creative processes. He wrote, "We begin with objects that look dissimilar. We compare, find patterns, analogies with what we already know. We distance ourselves and create abstractions, laws, systems, using transformations, mappings, and metaphors. This is how mathematics grows increasingly abstract and powerful. It is how music obtains much of its power, with grand structures growing out of small details. This form of comprehension underlies much of Western thought. We pursue knowledge that is universal in its perspective, but its powers are grounded in the particular. We use principles that are shared, but reveal details that are distinct." Now compare that insight with the following independent account of creativity in the physical sciences. The writer is Hideki Yukawa, who spent his career working on the nuclear binding forces of the atom, making discoveries for which he became the first Japanese to receive the Nobel Prize in Physics. He wrote, "Suppose there is something which a person cannot understand. He happens to notice the similarity of this something to some other thing, which he understands quite well. By comparing them, he may come to understand the thing which he could not understand up to that moment. If his understanding turns out to be appropriate, and nobody else has ever come to such an understanding, he can claim that his thinking was really creative." The arts, like the sciences, start in the real world. They then reach out to all possible worlds, and finally to all conceivable worlds. Throughout, they project the human presence on everything in the universe. Given the power of metaphor, perhaps the arts began with what may be called the Picasso effect. The artist is reported by his photographer and chronicler, Brassai, to have said in 1943, "If it occurred to man to create his own images, it's because he discovered them all around him, almost formed, already within his grasp. He saw them in a bone, in the irregular surfaces of cavern walls, in a piece of wood. One form might suggest a woman, another a bison, and still another the head of a demon." They may have come that route by perception of what Gregory Bateson and Tyler Volk have called meta-patterns, those circles, spheres, borders, and centers, binaries, layers, cycles, breaks, and other geometric configurations that occur repeatedly in nature and provide easily recognized clues to the identity of more complicated objects. It was but a short step, not just to see, but to recreate images on rock walls with charcoal lines or by etchings on stone, bone, and wood. The first faltering steps were attempts to stimulate and thereby humanize external nature. The art historian Vincent Scully has observed that in early historical times, people constructed sacred buildings to resemble mountains, rivers, and animals. By so doing, they hoped to draw upon the powers of the environment. The greatest ceremonial site of pre-Columbian America, in Scully's opinion, is Teotihuacan in central Mexico. There, the Avenue of the Dead runs directly to the base of the Temple of the Moon, behind which rises the mountain that is called Tenan, Our Lady of Stone. That mountain, running with springs, is basically